This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Dreary winter weather hit New Hampshire again this week with dangerous driving conditions disrupting many commutes. On Tuesday morning, Bill Boynton of the New Hampshire Department of Transportation warned drivers about the slick roads.
Pavement temperatures hovering around 30, air temperatures around the freezing mark, and it's still raining. That has a great potential for slippery road conditions. So probably throughout the rest of the day, people just need to be aware of what's going on out there and drive accordingly and avoid driving if you can.
Meanwhile, agencies like the DOT are bringing their funding requests as the governor puts together her budget for the next cycle. Just yesterday on The Exchange, New Hampshire Community College Chancellor Ross Cattell made his case for a small increase in funding.
The future of the New Hampshire economy depends on that highly skilled workforce. It depends upon ensuring that our high school graduates stay in New Hampshire and complete post-secondary training and education that's aligned with the economy, and that's fundamental to a strong economy and enabling economic opportunity in the state of New Hampshire.
Also this week, the New Hampshire Supreme Court ruled that the legislature did have the right to increase the amount state employees must contribute to their pensions. Here's Assistant Attorney General Richard Head, who argued for the state.
The New Hampshire Supreme Court's opinion is consistent with some of the other states that have ruled on this issue.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for this week's roundup are Kevin Landrigan, chief political correspondent for New Hampshire One News, a new media company based in Concord. Kevin, great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Great to be back, Laura.
Also with us, Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press. And Rick, thank you also for making time out.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, both of you, I'll start with you, Rick. Newly chosen House Speaker Sean Jasper chose his committee chairs this week. Now, it sounds bureaucratic. Why is this important?
Well, it signals a couple of different things. Jasper, of course, was sort of a surprise winner of the House speakership over Bill O'Brien in sort of a contentious vote. And when he came in, he signaled that he was going to not shake things up. He was going to appoint Republicans. He wasn't going to reward, other factions that may have voted for him for the speakership. And what he's also done is by appointing Republicans to the chairs, not only his own backers, but also some O'Brien backers, Lynn Ober, Rick Ladd was another one who spoke in favor of Bill O'Brien. They're in positions of power. What it does, I think anyway, is send a signal that he's going to let his committee chairs be the experts. He's really going to put the power in their hands. He's not going to try and run roughshod over them. They'll bring the best bills to the floor, and then hopefully they'll be able to pass those bills. So he's going to go back to the old way of really putting the expertise in the hands of the committee chair.
Interesting. And Kevin, how important are these positions, given that, unlike in Washington, where the committee chairs really kind of rule the roost, every bill gets a floor vote in New Hampshire, regardless of what the committee chair says?
It does. But the committee chairs can be really important in terms of setting the terms of the debate and controlling and trying to affirm what the committee decides. But as we've seen before, the House can be a very rambunctious place and can overturn committee reports and really does.
Herding cats, former Speaker Sitek used
exactly.
to call it.
This was a daunting task for the new speaker, but one he didn't really have much choice in the matter. I mean, when it was a secret ballot vote, but when you know if you're Sean Jasper that no more than 30 Republicans voted for you, now you've got to fill a leadership team with more than 60 people in it, if you count the committee chairs, the vice chairs, and the clerks, well, you're gonna end up picking a lot of people who didn't vote for you. But back to Rick's point, which is really an excellent one, the hallmark of Jasper's term as Speaker, he wants it to be not about him. It's important to remember that Sean Jasper turned to three or four people to take on Bill O'Brien. They all turned him down before he decided, well, I guess it falls to me. This is somebody who's been in the House for 20 years. He knows the people who are the brain trust on issues. So he knows Neil Kirk is the right person to chair the House Finance Committee with a very difficult budget coming up, by the way, even though Neil Kirk was at Bill O'Brien's side. The same way with John Hunt, who's the longtime chairman of the House Commerce Committee, the most capable person by far, a very close O'Brien insider. But a new speaker has that ability with a leadership to designate your first lieutenants, basically the people who are going to take the bullets for you. And if you look at that group, they're all new people. Jack Flanagan, majority leader, who was one of only five or six people who stuck with Jasper from the very beginning, when a lot of people who liked Jasper said, this is a bad idea. Bill O'Brien's going to embarrass you on the floor. Kathleen Hosel was another. She's now the election laws chairman. And I think a rising star in the House, Dick Hinch from Merrimack, who served on the Finance Committee, has a lot of energy, extremely likable guy, has been made the majority whip. You're going to see a lot of him on the floor. He's very popular among the members.
So new names, new faces for us to learn about when the new year opens. Rick, go ahead, jump back
in. Yeah, there's still sort of an unfinished question, too. Bill O'Brien was to have gathered a group of Republicans earlier in the week. I think the weather shut down the first meeting. That meeting still has not been rescheduled, and we'll see, because I think O'Brien has said, correct me if I'm wrong, that he's not going to recognize the new leadership. And so now you've got sort of this interesting tension. When is that meeting going to happen, if it ever does, and what comes of it?
Now, what does that mean, I'm not going to recognize the new leadership? I mean, Sean Jasper's Speaker of the House, and, you know, he got it with a majority of votes. So what does that mean, Kevin?
He is, but the bylaws of the Republican State Committee essentially say no elected official may serve on the executive committee unless they're the choice of the Republican Party.
That's right. I did read that.
And yeah. Bill O'Brien was, of course, the choice. And that's why after this canceled meeting, we're really not sure if they're going to bring it all back together. But Republican chairman, for now at least, has named Bill O'Brien to that position on the executive committee.
All right. One more question about Republican Party politics. But I also want to invite our listeners to join us. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're going to cover a whole bunch of stories today, starting off with statehouse politics. We'll also be looking at pipeline politics in southern New Hampshire and the possibility of a marijuana dispensary in Franklin. All that we'll be covering this hour. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. I also want to remind everybody, it is the waning hours of NHPR's December Fund Drive. You can pledge to help keep the exchange on the air at nhpr.org. So one more question, Kevin, I'll throw this to you about statehouse politics. State Party Chair Jennifer Horn of the GOP says she'd like another term. Was that a surprise, or did everybody think, no, I think Jennifer Horn's going to stick around for a while?
Yeah, I don't think it was a surprise. I think mainly because how much she got helped down the ballot. Certainly when you saw Jeanne Shaheen and Governor Maggie Hassan get reelected, there might have been some in the Republican Party who said, well, maybe it's time for a change. But because Walt Havenstein did so well in the race for governor, getting over 47%, as we've talked about, that's flipped the House, the New Hampshire House, from Democrat back to Republican, and the Republicans actually gained a seat in the state Senate. So she can say we had some accomplishments there. A number of establishment Republicans have already weighed in, such as former governor and former Republican chairman John H. Sununu and Bill O'Brien have both said we think Jennifer Horn deserves another 2 years. But I'm sure there'll be someone probably from the right – who challenges her in this race, but she's the overwhelming favorite.
All right. Well, you mentioned earlier, Kevin, budget season and how Neil Kirk will be the chair of the House Finance Committee. I did want to ask both of you guys about the budget requests that have been coming through, and we've been following this for a couple of weeks. But to you, I think, Rick Stevens, Chris Clement, the outgoing commissioner for the Department of Transportation, had some thoughts on the budget before he left office. What did he say?
That's right. Chris Clement sat down with Kathleen Ronan from the AP this week for an interview as he leaves. And this is not a new message from Chris Clement. He said that the transportation fund, particularly the highway fund, has been raided and underfunded for years. And as a result, this hits everybody in this state, whether it's a busted axle on your car because of the potholes or, you know, a longer ride to school because a bridge happens to be closed. This is really meat and potatoes stuff for folks in New Hampshire. He says right now that the highway fund looks like it could face a $50 million deficit by the end of next year or by the middle of this coming year. And this is a fund. It's only about $260 million annually. So that's a big chunk if you're talking about a 20% deficit by the middle of next year. What he'd like to do is see the state rethink the way they fund this thing. Maybe this will not be popular with many people, but maybe they nudge the gas tax up again. Maybe they increase vehicle registration fees. Or, and this is kind of an interesting one, people who drive non-gasoline-only vehicles, hybrids or electric cars, maybe they have to pay a little more because they're not paying the gas tax.
Yeah, we'll other states are looking at that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. It's not strictly a New Hampshire thing. One thing that stuck out to me from Chris's comments, $330 a year in maintenance just simply related to bad roads in this state per person, per driver. That's a lot of money when you're talking about, the damage to your car and the work that the state needs to do on the roads.
So he would say you're paying anyway.
Yeah, you're paying anyway. The other thing, a fascinating detail, had they done I-93, had they kept this highway fund robust enough to do I-93 when they wanted to, 20 years or so ago, it would have cost about, $35 million? And now, when they finally finish the expansion of I-93, $800 million project.
Because the costs of pavement and so forth
keep
going up. So one more follow-up for that for you, Kevin. Okay, the gas tax did go up this year by about 4 cents per gallon, first time in more than 20 years. So why is outgoing Commissioner Clement still talking about a big deficit in the highway fund?
Well, I think because folks that supported that gas tax really acknowledged when they passed it that this is plugging the hole. In other words, the whole being over 40% of this gas tax increase was dedicated to completing that long-awaited project that Rick just talked about, the widening of 93. So only about half of it goes to roads and bridges, other roads and bridges. And when nearly 40% of your roads and bridges are rated as being in poor condition, then 4-cent gas tax isn't going to do it. Keep in mind, 5 years ago, now retiring House Public Works and Chairman David Campbell, who's kind of the architect of the gas tax increase, wanted a 12-cent increase in the gas tax. I just don't know if there's really the political will to go back to this well again. One possibility that maybe – I don't think they're going to go with another gas tax increase. But one possibility is that in 2009, Governor Lynch – approved a $30 surcharge on your registration each year, which provided about $50 million.
And then that was repealed.
And that was repealed by the Republicans when they took over. I think there'll be some serious talk about restoring something like that. Again, maybe on a temporary basis, just to take care of some of this backlog of infrastructure that needs a lot of work.
All right. Well, coming up, more pipeline drama along New Hampshire's southern border. Also, applications for marijuana dispensaries are coming in. We'll take a look at one of them. Stay with us for the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. Let's check in now with our short December fund drive. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Let's turn now to southern New Hampshire and a story there that highlights New Hampshire's broader debate over our energy future. This latest story involves a planned natural gas pipeline that would cut through the state's southern tier. Joining us now with more on that is David Brooks, longtime reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. And Dave, thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
Oh, you bet.
So how long is this pipeline and how many New Hampshire towns would it go through?
It is 76 miles, I believe, in New Hampshire, and I believe it's a dozen altogether. I'd be honest, I haven't actually tallied them up like that. So this is the pipeline from Kinder Morgan, which is the parent company of Tennessee Gas Pipeline Company, that they before we're talking about bringing it across northern Massachusetts with a little lateral through Hollis that got some, shall we say, opposition there. They have now said they want to move in pretty much the whole pipeline north into New Hampshire. It would come into New Hampshire in the town of Winchester, right by the Vermont border, coming up from Massachusetts. And it would sort of cut across, following almost the entire time it would follow a PSNH high power line. So there's already a right-of-way, and there's already some energy stuff happening, which will make it a lot easier to get approved because there won't be quite so many landowners who would have to have a pipeline running through them.
So where would the natural gas be coming from? We keep hearing about all this natural gas in New York and Pennsylvania, and New England's not getting it. Is that where this is coming from?
Exactly. And in fact, this is only part of a proposed project. Kinder Morgan's actually proposing $5 billion. There's really big money with these projects. These are massive projects. $5 billion worth of pipeline expansions, a lot of it in New York and Pennsylvania that would connect some various shale fields to existing networks. And then part of it would be this one, which would bring more gas, a couple billion cubic feet east to the basically to the Boston market, up to connections to existing pipelines in Londonderry, and it would cut pretty much, as I say, straight east west across the southern part of the tier, come through the Sauhegan Valley, Amherst, Merrimack. It would cross underneath. They would tunnel underneath the river, as is pretty routine for giant pipelines these days. Right near the Anheuser-Busch plant in Merrimack, if you know where that is, and then. And cut across to, as I say, to I-93 in Londonderry, where there are pipelines.
And you mentioned that it would be following existing rights of way for PSNH, I think you said. So do the affected communities have any say in where this pipeline is sited, or is it pretty much a done deal?
No, it's not a done deal at all. And New Hampshire has the siting committee, the legislature established, that does have to say, yes, we agree that it needs to go here. So the first step is going to be the feds, the FERC, which is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. They have to say this pipeline makes sense and should go forward. They probably will. That'll happen this come next fall. And after that, the argument will start about the exact siting, which, as I say, the state siting committee will have to agree on it. The towns don't have any direct say necessarily, although they do have indirect say and push with their legislators on the committee.
Well, and one last question for you, Dave, please. You have mentioned in your reporting not just the facts about this particular pipeline, but how it fits into this bigger picture of New England's struggle to put its energy future on a better footing. Just give us a little context there, please, Dave, how this fits into the larger questions and debates that we're having right now about New Hampshire's energy future.
Sure. I mean, most of us are going to see much higher electricity rates this winter. We're going to be paying higher bills because of this whole question. It's all because of all the gas that has been found close to us, but not quite here, which seems sort of like a good thing. But what has happened is it means that awful lot of electricity is now produced by gas-fired plants. We can't get enough natural gas into New England in the wintertime because most of it's used for heating, and so those electricity plants have to pay huge amounts of money to get gas to keep generating it, and they pass that on to us in the rates. And there are businesses that are saying they're going to have to actually shut down or at least curtail some of their business in the wintertime because they can't get natural gas to keep operating their plants, or else it'll cost them such a fortune they won't bother operating. There is a bigger argument that, frankly, this is our opportunity to get away from using fossil fuels, and instead of spending $5 billion, and there's several companies, there's at least three major pipeline plants to come into New England. I mean, so we're talking $6, $8, $10, $12 billion total. I don't know, huge amounts of money being proposed. Instead of doing that, perhaps this is our opportunity to redesign our system and go with microgrids and distributed generation and demand response and intelligent things that would make it less necessary to pull stuff out of the ground and burn it. But that's very complicated, and frankly, I'll be very honest, probably won't happen. I imagine we will probably go with the obvious thing, which in this case is to bring in more gas, despite all the money it's going to cost.
Okay. Dave, thank you very much. We'll talk to you again soon.
You bet. Bye-bye.
That's Dave Brooks, reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua, updating us on a new pipeline proposal cutting into southern New Hampshire. You can join us on this story and some of the others that we're covering this hour on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. I also want to remind everybody, it is NHPR's short December fund drive. You can make a pledge to help the exchange right now at nhpr.org. And Rick Stevens, Kevin Landergan, here's an email that came in from Christopher in Manchester. He says, regarding the list of chairs and co-chair names in the paper this morning, I was struck by the concentration of power in the southern tier, almost all from Hillsborough and Rockingham counties. Christopher says, how would this affect legislation and expenditures in the new session? Christopher, it's a very astute point. Thank you for making it. It gets back to our early conversation, Kevin. I think it was you who said that there are a lot of new faces in terms of leadership at the House.
Yeah, no, that's true. Christopher, that's a great question. I think it does speak to, you know, it's a 400-member House, and the membership is really dominated by where the people live. So you have Hillsborough and Rockingham County that together, just two counties, have almost 200 members of the House. So invariably, when you're looking for people in leadership, you often turn to those communities. But certainly, new House Speaker Sean Jasper is sensitive to the needs of the conquered North. And it's a constant push-me-pull-you. And it's one of the reasons why legislators from those smaller counties, from Carroll County, from Coos County, from Grafton County, all essentially say, we feel neglected because we're outnumbered.
Well, thank you, Christopher, for the email. You can email us to exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Rick Stevens, I'm wondering if anyone from Franklin will call, because it was a big headline out of the city of Franklin this week. A Franklin businessman wants to apply for a license to open a medical marijuana dispensary. Just step back for a second, Rick, if you could please just remind us how this fits into the whole bigger picture of New Hampshire's medical marijuana law.
The state approved marijuana for medical use in 2013. I think they had 2 years to actually implement the rules about how it would be dispensed, who would dispense it, and what the qualifications would be to receive it. This is also part of a national trend. I think there are a few dozen, 30 or so states that have approved medical marijuana laws now. So in steps Paul Morissette of Loudoun, or rather Franklin. He owns the Regal Auction Services. He's got several commercial properties. He's a businessman. He initially opposed or wasn't crazy about the state's medical marijuana law. And then he said, wait, I'm a businessman and there's a business opportunity here. And I love his comment to I think it was the Monitor, where he says, I'm not in this for humanitarian reasons. He's a businessman. So now what they need to do is figure out where they can put this facility that would distribute, you know, warehouse and distribute the marijuana that would be used by ill people. He's already spending a lot of money on it. He's working with teams that have developed dispensaries in other states. So it's a serious foray into this new business venture. It's not being received well by everybody, of course. The mayor of Franklin, Ken Merrifield, he opposes the project. He's opposed to the marijuana law. And as he points out, they're fighting drug abuse in Franklin, including marijuana. Of course, we've seen other drug use and abuse skyrocket in the state, mostly opiates and heroin and painkillers. But there's a component of marijuana abuse as well. So he's not really thrilled about having a marijuana dispensary in his town.
Yeah, well, the Monitor did a real interesting piece on it. And you're right, quoting the mayor as well as this man who wants to set up the dispensary. And when I read it, Kevin, I thought, wow, what kind of hurdles might these dispensary applications face when, you know, kind of the rubber hits the road? I mean, it's one thing to say philosophically we believe in medical marijuana. It's another thing to say, and we're going to put a dispensary, you know, downtown, not far from your high school.
Yeah, no, it's true. And it can be of great expense. This particular Franklin proposal, they've talked about spending as much as $100,000 just to try and get all the permits and trying to get the ducks in a row. One thing that doesn't ameliorate that, but certainly speaks to what Rick was talking about a little bit earlier, this is big business and growing business across the country. So you're seeing a lot of these large companies. MariMed is one that has moved in with this Franklin proposal. And I talked to the Concord City Deputy City Manager last month about this. He said, we've had six different interests say we're interested
in Concord.
In Concord as a medical marijuana dispensary. And he indicated to me that none of them were property owners, meaning all of them were companies that are in this business. MariMed, for example, has medical marijuana dispensaries now operating in six states and the District of Columbia. They're in this business. It's a good thing they are because, as I said before, the startup, the costs to get ready are significant. The state has a licensing fee of $80,000, which is again, significant. It's used to pay for the regulations. And you need horsepower, and you need companies that have this experience, and here's why. Because the landscape calls for a very tight window here. We're talking the state under this law has to develop and approve at least two licenses by January 23rd.
Yeah, it's coming up.
A little over 2 months from now. Then the law and the rules say that anybody who's granted this license within 90 days needs all local approvals to operate. That's why you're getting these companies trying to get ahead of the licensing process. Usually it'd be the other way around. First you get the license, then you go to the community. They don't have the time to do that.
Sure. Rick, go ahead.
And you're right, Kevin. 90 days, they've got a lot of things to answer to. How are they going to store it? What's the security measure? What kind of marijuana is going to be grown and dispensed? And then you've got just the local, you know, think of trying to put a gas station on the corner. You've got your local zoning regulations. So there's a lot of different layers. It's a very tightly regulated industry. And as Kevin rightly points out, short window to get there.
Well, and most schools anyway are, you know, you see the signs, this is a drug-free
right.
school zone. So,
right.
I mean, I'm thinking about Concord anyway. There's schools everywhere, sprinkled all over the city.
There are. And a couple of things to remember. The Department of Health and Human Services has been working pretty hard on this, slowly, but they have been working hard on it. And then looking at a couple of things. One, the law says no more than four licenses, at least at this stage. So they've actually created a map and gerrymandered the state to make it so that those four licenses will not require anybody who lives in the state to drive, say, more than an hour to get to one of the dispensaries. This is really important, particularly up in the North Country, back to Christopher's question about where the people are. This gerrymandered map that they've created, for example, has about 45% of the land mass all sort of north of Franklin being one area where this fourth license would be awarded. Now, in order to create, going back to where the people are, in order to create an incentive for a company like MariMed to locate, say, in Plymouth with their dispensary, they're going to cut the licensing fee in half from $80,000 to $40,000.
Potential customers.
Exactly,
there.
And less of a profit margin.
All right. Very interesting to see this starting to roll out in concrete form, and I'm sure we'll be following up on this story in later news roundups. We do need to take a quick break here, though. Coming up, we'll talk a little presidential politics. A draft Ben Carson office opens up in the Granite State. And if you don't know who Ben Carson is, you'll just have to keep it right here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Let's check in now very quickly with our December fund drive. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can join us on some of the stories that we've been covering this hour, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Rick Stevens is here, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press, along with Kevin Landrigan, chief political correspondent for New Hampshire One News, a new media company based in Concord. And gentlemen, I did want to turn to presidential politics. Yes, yes, I know it's early, but there was some news this week. Rick Stevens, a draft Ben Carson movement kicked off in New Hampshire. Before we talk about what's happening right here in the Granite State, who's Ben Carson?
Ben Carson, a very interesting figure. He's a pediatric neurologist who at the age of 33 became the youngest head of a major department at Johns Hopkins in Maryland, which is quite a feat in and of its own self. He's also got conservative Republicans really fired up. He's incredibly articulate. He's a very passionate and charismatic speaker. He pretty famously had a speech not long ago with President Obama sitting next to him, just shredded the Affordable Care Act, or as Dr. Ben Carson calls it, the Unaffordable Care Act. He is unapologetic about his views. He's also rub some people the wrong way with some of his more conservative views, including abortion rights and same-sex marriage, et cetera. So now Dr. Ben Carson has a field office, at least this draft movement, to draft him into the presidential contest for 2016. They've opened a facility down in Manchester, and they're already starting to raise some money hand over fist, which is very interesting at this early stage as well. The establishment Republicans, and I'll let Kevin speak a little bit more about this, but they're not quite sure what to think about this.
Yeah, is this the Herman Cain?
Yeah, is this the Herman
this time
Cain
around? Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting. And speaking of the establishment Republicans, I'm glad you said something, Rick Stevens. Earlier this week, we talked with political junkie Ken Rudin about this, on how major Republican donors want more control of the process, that those giving large amounts of cash to Republican presidential hopefuls don't want a wide-open, free-ranging process like last time. They don't want a Herman Cain, Kevin. So how does Ben Carson fit into that narrative?
Yeah, that can be a real problem for establishment Republicans, much like sort of their Ross Perot, who obviously became an independent candidate for president and certainly cost the Republicans any hope of defeating Bill Clinton when Ross Perot got 21%. I mean, Ben Carson's story is just fabulous. I mean, this is a story of the ultimate overachiever coming from the inner city of Detroit, being raised by a single mom, later in life even developing prostate cancer himself and becoming a cancer survivor and a best-selling author. But I've seen this movie before. I mean, you referred to Herman Cain in 2012. We had Maury Taylor in 1996. In every presidential cycle, when there's no heir apparent right away, invariably have wealthy, successful people who've never been elected to anything essentially say, I could be president. And Ben Carson's got a lot going for him. But back to Ken Rudin's point, the accoutrements of the Republican Party and the nominating process really work against someone from the outside of the establishment, like Ben Carson.
It's interesting, though. It's not stopping the enthusiasm, Kevin,
no,
of his local backers. They're raising money. They've got an office in Manchester and so forth.
And he's got a lot of devotees, a lot of passionate followers.
$12 million I think they've raised already, which is fast out of the gate. It is early. Look, what have we got, 13, 14 months before this primary? But it's a wide-open field. The interesting thing, too, about Carson is in May of 2013, he says, nope, this is nothing I aspire to, not for me. And then suddenly, tune changes a little bit in the last year. So as he gets sort of this cachet about within the party, now he says, maybe there's a different plan for me.
Well, the attention is flattering, I'm sure. And, you know, why not, right? It's America. And, in fact, I think one of his supporters said in one of the newspapers, look, we're not going to let the establishment pick this for us. So he's picking up on that sentiment. Okay, so that's on the right. On the left, Kevin, there was news of a draft Elizabeth Warren effort, possibly here in New Hampshire and also Iowa. So there we have yet another instance of someone being drafted who right now, just like Ben Carson says, no way.
Yeah, I think in the Democratic Party, there is sort of this pulse that should we just hand it to Hillary Clinton? I mean, after 8 years of President and Obama, I think frankly in both parties there's some fatigue with the old names. Are we going to have a Jeb Bush, Hillary Clinton race for president? I think Republicans feel energized by the fact that there is no heir apparent, including Jeb Bush. It's really the first time since before World War II. It's always been Mitt Romney's turn. It's John McCain's turn. It's Bob Dole's turn. On the Democratic side, there are Democrats who say, I want to keep shopping. And Elizabeth Warren is a fascinating character. Burst on the scene, beat Scott Brown for the Massachusetts Senate seat. Very, very liberal, very anti-Wall Street. Has attracted a lot of attention there. And there's several other Democrats who are waiting in the wings for Hillary Clinton to decide either, you know, my health is an issue, I'm not going to run, or whatever she might decide. I did a story for NH1 earlier this week on the super PACs in 2014 in the midterm elections and found that, you know, Elizabeth Warren had her own super PAC called for a level playing field PAC. Martin O'Malley, the The retiring Maryland governor had his own Oh Say Can You See PAC.
I love these names,
you know,
by the way.
I know.
I'm going to make my own PAC.
And both of them made significant contributions, strategic contributions, you call them, certainly, to Democratic candidates and causes. And they were, like I said, they're all in that same role, which is what if Hillary's a no-go, or what if there is this palpable sense that she needs a fight?
All right. Let's take a call. And this is Mary in Madison. Hi, Mary. Thanks for calling in. You're on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup.
Oh, hello. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I just want to make a point that one of your guests, I'm sorry, I forget his name, when he was given a brief bio on Dr. Ben Carson. Dr. Carson is a pediatric neurosurgeon, not a pediatric neurologist.
Okay.
And I just wanted to point that out. Right. And I also got a little bit of a sense that your guests think he's somewhat of a lightweight. I've been listening to this man for some time now, and I think he makes a lot of good points. He's very smart. And we have to remember that our president, Barack Obama, really didn't have much experience when he took office either. So.
Yeah, just a few years in the U.S. Senate and some time in the Illinois legislature.
Yeah,
so it sounds like you're interested, Mary, in Ben Carson.
I am. I think he seems like a very smart, sensible man. I don't find him too, I wouldn't call him extreme right. I just think he's very sensible.
Okay.
And I do think we need to start looking at candidates that have a little bit more, are in the middle, a little bit more moderate, and so we can get some things done.
But, okay,
Mary. Thank you for taking my call, Laura.
No, I really appreciate you coming on, and especially with that correction, a pediatric neurosurgeon. And, you know, sounds like somebody we're going to be talking about for a while, guys, in terms of his politics and where he stands and so forth. Did you want to jump in?
Yeah, just that I hope Mary didn't get the wrong idea. I mean, that was quite the opposite. I think this is a super substantial guy. I mean, President Bush gave him the President Bush bestowed on him the Presidential Medal of Freedom before he left office, which typically is
that's a big deal.
That's a very big deal. I mean, he's written four books, including his autobiography, Gifted Hands, in 1996, which was a runaway bestseller.
All right. Thank you again for the call and for the correction, Mary. Gentlemen, I often like to end the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup with some more fun stories. And here's one that caught our eye that we just love this story. This is from the Associated Press, Rick. So this might be one of your folks who wrote it. A bicentennial American flag that was stolen 40 years ago from a park has been returned by a remorseful thief. The flag was stolen in 1976. While the Weston Observatory in Manchester was being repaired, someone climbed the scaffolding, snatched the flag at night, causing an uproar in the community, WMUR-TV reported. Here's the kicker, though. The flag was recently mailed to the Manchester Historical Association from Arizona with a note of apology signed by a, quote, flawed son of Manchester. So I love that story. There's another story that caught my eye, Rick, because I like to get outdoors. This is an initiative being pushed by the state called First Day Hikes. What is this?
Yeah, they're encouraging people to get out into New Hampshire's natural resources on New Year's Day with First Day Hikes at three state parks, Monadnock, Weeks State Park in Lancaster, and Wentworth Coolidge Mansion in Portsmouth.
So make good on that New Year's resolution.
That's right. Started with a hike instead of a hangover.
Well, next week on The Exchange, I just want to let everybody know about this. We're kicking off a really fun project on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. We want to play back the best of 2014 programs over the last week of December. And we'd like listeners to vote. So we'll put up our staff's top 10 picks. And at midnight tonight, you can start voting for your favorites. You can go to nhpr.org/exchange. Help us select the best exchange shows of 2014, and then you can listen to them the last week of the year. Kevin Landrigan, Rick Stevens, thank you so much for giving us your time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us, Laura.
Thanks for having me. Thanks.
This is The Exchange on NHPR, checking in now with our December fund drive.